the Health and Human Services for the Senate order. Got a couple of bills we want to introduce here for the and have a public hearing on briefly for purposes of keeping them alive. I'm going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 633. The staff give the introduction.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 633 is brought to the committee by the Senate Interim Judiciary Committee for the Judicial Department. It establishes dispute resolution process for dispute between the ambulance service provider and payers as to the amount payable for services rendered under city franchise or county plans, and applies to services that are paid for or subject to reimbursements under the Oregon Health Plan.
I'm going to make note that we are in subcommittee. I close the public hearing on Senate Bill 633 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 883.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 883, sponsored by Senator Shannon at the request of Joanne and Claude Durr. The bill defines family unity meeting and extended family.
Public hearing on Senate Bill 883 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 919.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 919 is at the request of Senator Corcoran, sponsored by Senator Corcoran at the request of Sally Alton. It requires the Department of Human Resources to provide community-based services, including home care to persons with mental retardation or other developmental disabilities. It appropriates money from the general fund to the department for provisions of community-based services, including home care to persons with mental retardation or other developmental disabilities. It declares an emergency and is effective July 1, 1999.
Okay. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 919. I want to open a public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 40. And as soon as we get the list, we'll Dan Higginson.
Yeah. Which one did you just do?
I just did tap
on this one.
633, 883, and 919.
Okay, good.
Senator Fisher, members of the committee, Senator Duncan. For the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the State Health Officer and Deputy Administrator of the Oregon Health Division, and I'm here today in support of Senate Joint Resolution 40. Oregon has made progress in improving our immunization rate throughout the 1990s. However, we still have a long ways to go. A recent survey showed that only 75% of our children around the two-year-old age marker are adequately immunized with their childhood immunizations, and that ranks low compared to the rest of the country. One of the things that we have been investing in to try to improve our immunization rates is an immunization registry called Immunization Alert. And actually, this registry has gotten a lot of recognition both around the state and nationally. And one of the reasons it's felt to be innovative and creative is because of the public-private partnership that we have. We have over 90% of all private providers that are providing immunizations signed up to participate in the registry, and over half of the funding for Immunization Alert comes from the private side, from OSIC, which is Oregon Health Systems in Collaboration, which is a group of not only the Health Division and the Multnomah County Health Department, but then the six largest health insurers or health systems in the metropolitan area as well. So what this resolution is doing is really commending the work of that group in creating Immunization Alert, and we're hopeful that this kind of resolution and support from the legislature will help us to sustain long-term funding for that project. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Grant, can you maybe give us a little briefing on how many different things we're required here in Oregon to be in the United States.
Senator Fisher, I can get you a detailed outline, and it is something that actually is always changing. But currently, we have measles, mumps, rubella, diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, hepatitis B, Haemophilus influenza, and I believe that's it for the childhood immunizations. But we can get you a schedule. It is a rather complicated schedule, and that's one of the reasons why we think that having a registry is important, is because not only are we keeping track of what immunizations children have gotten, we have a tracking system in place so that we can get to providers so they can then get to their patients when they need to come in for future immunizations.
Grant, from time to time, you know, you get some kind of updated information and things like that, and I recently received some information on hepatitis B that brought it into real question as to the necessity of having that on the list, and also the actual value of the immunization in comparison to some of the problems that it was causing. And I don't know if you're prepared or not, but are you aware of some of the accusations and stuff that have been made against the practice of just mass vaccination for hepatitis B?
Chair Fisher, yes I am. And what we do is we really rely on the recommendations that come out of two groups. One is the American Academy of Pediatrics, and then there's a group through the Centers for Disease Control that looks at immunization practices, as well, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. And both of those organizations have recommended hepatitis B as part of the routine schedule. And with a lot of immunizations, there are some people who question the adverse reactions, but from us looking at the data and from us looking at the recommendations from those national organizations, we believe that the benefit outweighs the risk.
Yeah, again, as I hear you say this, this is not something that is being asked for in a way of costing the state a lot of money.
Excuse me, sir?
I say this is not something that's going to cost the state a lot of money to rise herd on and that type of thing.
Chair Fisher, that's absolutely correct. What we're asking for is really something that's going to help us, I think, sustain long-term funding from the private sector. One thing that OSIC, the Oregon Health Systems in Collaboration, would like to have happen is to get more health plans and insurers invested in the system and to get them paying their fair shares as well. And I think one of the beliefs here is that if this is something that clearly has legislative support, that that's something that they can use, the CEOs of those organizations can use to encourage others to participate in the system as well. So if anything, it should actually help to save the state's participation and save the state some money. But no, this would not do anything in the way of committing the state to more funding.
To your knowledge, the most of the insurance companies provide these shots and immunizations and so forth in their medical plans.
Chair Fisher, that's correct. The majority of them do.
Thank you very much. Public hearing on SJR 40, and open a public hearing on SJR 29. Glenn Dayton.
Thank you, and good morning, Chair Fisher, members of the committee. I think Joe Bell from the Hospital Association also wanted to testify, and we can actually even talk to the panel. That'd be more convenient this morning.
I'm glad to welcome you here to the table.
Chair Fisher, members of the committee, I'm Gwen Dayton from Oregon Healthcare Association. The Oregon Healthcare Association represents nursing facilities, assisted living, residential care facilities, and we're here in support of this bill. This resolution establishes a interim task force to examine issues related to the long-term care direct caregiver workforce. And when we talk about direct caregiver workforce, we're talking about hands-on caregivers like PNAs or licensed practical nurses, registered nurses, and others that provide the daily care to the frail and elderly disabled in our long-term care facilities and those that receive care in their own homes. When I talk to our members about what their greatest concern is, I always receive the same answer, and that is that the greatest challenge for them is to hire and retain good people care for their residents and patients. And in fact, the challenges in front of them are immense in doing that. We're looking at an already tight labor market, so this isn't a real big pool out there of full-time, any jobs, not just direct caregivers. And unfortunately, those who provide long-term care don't have the resources to pay the wage that really fully compensates folks for the hard work they do. The average wage for a CNA is approximately $8 an hour. And before the increases in the minimum wage, it wasn't sufficient even then, but with the increases in the minimum wage, it's fairly above what that person could get working at Taco Bell or in a position that requires much less hands-on care. And we pay them that wage for doing very difficult work. We pay them that kind of wage for heavy lifting, for caring for people that have often behavioral issues. This is very difficult work that they do, but very necessary work that they do. And once you get someone who is interested in this difficult job that doesn't pay all that much money, of course, LPNs and RNs have to be licensed. Certified nursing assistants have to go through at least 10 minutes of CR training. They have to pass a criminal record check, all caregivers do, and drug and alcohol screening. So all of these are necessary hoops and we support them, but they further limit the pool of appropriate people. And you add to that, and I think Joe can speak to this more than I can, that there is an existing shortage of nurses across all care settings. It's not just long-term care. If you look in the Sunday classifieds under nursing, you'll see ads, ad after ad after ad, looking for nurses, offering incredible bonuses to bring on more nurses. So independent of the other factor that we're discussing, that there just aren't very many nurses out there to be hired. And once they are hired, it's hard to keep the good people on board. Odds are somebody that is hired as first of the year won't be there at the end of the year. The average turnover rate in long-term care is approximately 73%. All the work that goes into bringing on a good person, they don't necessarily stay. So, and the problem isn't going away. I'd like to say that it's just a cyclical issue and we think if we just kind of hold on for a few more years, it'll get better, but no. We are going to need more long-term care, not less. Our population is aging. The population over 85 is estimated to quadruple, and those are the folks that use long-term care. And it's estimated that we'll need 22% more CNAs in the next 5 years and an astounding 88% more home health aides in the next 5 years to care for our aging population. And this is happening at the same time that the workforce is not getting that much bigger. Our older population is growing, but our workforce, younger population, is keeping pace. So the challenge is only going to increase. This task force will look at the current barriers that exist, and
work on ways to eliminate some of those barriers, look at what's working, look at those facilities that are able to hire and retain good people and see what they're doing. Try to find a way to make working in long-term care a career that people seek so that we can get good people, compassionate people, trained people, caring for those who need them. I urge your support of this bill.
Okay. I'm going to officially go into the full session. We have enough members here to do so. And Ms. Bell, go ahead now.
Senator Fisher, members of the committee, my name is Joe Bell, and I'm with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And I also would like to urge your support of SDR 29. We have been working with the Oregon Association of Healthcare just recently, working on the issues of availability of staffing. As you're probably well aware, there is a critical nursing shortage, and we've been working on that issue for some time. And as you may know, in the past, these kinds of shortages have been cyclical. I haven't been around long enough to know this, but I understand that about every 6 to 8 years there's been a nursing shortage in the past. There's some differences this time that we see. One of those, Gwen has already mentioned, and that is that there is an increasing number of older people who will be needing the care. The second thing is that the workforce is aging as well, and we've been doing some work with our nurse executives, for instance, in the hospitals. And after talking about this issue, one of the nursing execs went back to a facility and just sort of did an eyeball count of their staff and determined that about 65% of their nursing staff would retire in the next 5 to 8 years, and that there was not an equal number of young people coming in to take their place. So we think that this is not going to be just one of those cyclical nursing shortages, and we believe that it's going to be something we're going to have to work on, not just for long-term care, but for all kinds of acute care. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you for coming. And haven't you come more than 100 miles?
I think so.
You didn't put it down here, but I...
Good morning.
You heard me corrected. It made quite a little trip to get here.
Good morning, Chairman Fisher, members of the committee. I am Phyllis Lisman, and I chair the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. And in response to Senator Fisher, your chair, and to the committee, I say, yes, I did come over 100 miles. I live in Harney County, Burns, Oregon. And while it's quite a drive, I feel that the issues that the commission brings forward to this committee and other committees are very important to the people of Oregon, and I'm very glad to be able to serve. Chairman Fisher, members of the commission urged the committee to give favorable consideration to Senate Joint Resolution 29. We believe that the Oregon model of long-term care would be well served if more members of the legislature had the opportunity to study problems with the development of a long-term care workforce in the future. We applaud Senator Qtub for her sponsorship and for the objectives found in Senate Joint Resolution 29. The workforce that we speak of here is the very core of the Oregon model, because these are the people who care for the frail elderly and the disabled. It's not an easy job. It's sometimes long hours, as my worthy counterpart said ahead of me, hard work. The very core of the program depends on them. You know, there's another issue that always enters in here, too, and that is the fact that when we have turnover of these caregivers, this is a high emotional stress on the very people they're caring for. And we would like very much to see this group of people become paraprofessionals, to be a part of the workforce, not just a minimum wage or just above hourly jobs. And those that work, and we call them CPC CEPs, fine employees, providers in the home, no fringe benefits, difficult to get training. The commission has been working very hard to see if there was some way that funds can be provided to give these people some incentives to continue. You stay a year, you get a little more money. You stay 2 years, you get a little more money. You get a little extra dollars for taking additional training to not only make your job more rewarding and easier, but to make the services you deliver to these clients better. And it is with this that I urge that you people give careful consideration to this bill. You are partners in the Oregon model, and I think a better understanding created by the legislature and to the legislature will help move that model into the next biennium. And I thank you again for the opportunity to appear, and is there any questions?
Yes. Thank you for, the distance. Although my wife is from Dale, so
you understand.
But anyhow, I was just curious, thinking of parents in a small rural community, what kind of facilities do you have currently now? Do you have adequate facilities for the care of the elderly right now, or is that really a problem?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Duncan, let's break that question into two parts. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about facilities and staffing for that facility.
Mm-hmm.
Burns has been very fortunate over the past 2 years with the growth of the Oregon model. We now have a number. Of course, we have a nursing home, not skilled care, intermediate care. Fortunately, in facilities, we have 4 swing beds in our local hospital, which is of great help to those who need highly skilled care. We have 1 assisted living facility, which will be expanding in the very near future. It's full. There's a waiting list.
Mm-hmm.
We have just opened in the last month a residential care facility, which is 15 beds, and are looking at least 50% of those beds being for Alzheimer's patients, which is good. We have a number of foster care homes in the community for those people, as well as a good in-home service program operated through the local area agency. And I just had to say that because my background was 18 years of developing senior services in Harney County until my retirement. So I was there in the beginning. I've watched the Oregon model move forward. So we are beginning, even in our rural area, to have those facilities. Our biggest problem is actually getting and retaining the workforce necessary to provide the care in those facilities in the home. And that is why, both personally as a chair of the commission, that we highly recommend that this move forward so that all of you people can get a real grasp of what's happening.
That's true. I asked because my mother-in-law's in a nursing home in Dale, the family nursing home, and I'm amazed that they get this good of people as they do, and it is difficult. I know it's
very
and you get fine people, and most people need good care, and that's good.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, members of the committee, Senator Duncan, I would like to say and strengthen once again the other side of that coin, and that is the emotion in that is emotional problems that these people that are being cared for have with the turnover of caregivers. It's always amazing how attached these people get to their caregivers. They love them. They're really a part of their life. And I think that's important. And it's very hard on them when every 6 months, here we go, another caregiver, another stranger. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming. And it seems like the last session we passed a bill that allowed the hospital turned nursing home to turn assisted living in, was it Vail?
Not Vail. there has been...
One little town.
Okay, I noticed that Representative Butler is bringing forth a bill in this session, and I really can't tell you where it is, to do that for the Malheur Hospital in Nissa, what used to be the Malheur Hospital in Nissa. But I'm afraid I can't help you, Senator. It was not in Bern.
Well, it was something that Senator Kim said.
Okay. I have to talk to Senator Kims about this. He has shared it.
I know the Vail, the Pioneer Nursing Home in Vail, is now moving to an assisted wing for assisted care. So they have the nursing home, and now they're adding the nursing home. I think that was what we gave the permission to do. There was some restriction in the law. I believe that it was. I understand it. What happens there now is that you don't have to have the same number of
Senator Fisher, members of the committee, Senator Just, this is right. The law was changed so that it could be a wing of assisted living because they needed to make it so that it was not the number of staff for that particular one. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. I'm going to put a public hearing on SGR 29 and doing the work session on SGR 29.
Chair, I move SGR 29 to the floor with the DPAS recommendation.
We got to modify that a little bit. It has a fiscal impact of about $83,997, approximately $84,000, so we need to run that to ways and means.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, I move Senate Joint Resolution 29 to Ways and Means with the DPAS recommendation.
Senator Castillo moves SJR 29 to the Ways and Means Committee with the DuPont recommendation. Is there further discussion? Objection? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Joe?
Aye.
Senator Castillo?
Aye.
Senator Castillo?
Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye. Senator Fisher? Aye. Motion carries. Staff will take care of the formalities on this. Close the work session on SGR 29 and open a work session on SGR 40. Senator Shields, we held a public hearing. Grant Higginson gave his testimony, which we have here in a letter. There was no opposition. It has no fiscal impact, and I wanted to go right ahead and look at the bill.
I saw Grant out in the hall. I don't know if he wanted to come back in or not.
Mr. Chair, I will move that sent by resolution number 40 be sent to the floor with a DPAS recommendation. Senator Duncan moves SGR 40 to the Senate floor with a DPAS recommendation. Any further discussion or objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Do we have a carrier?
Do we have to vote?
Oh, I'm sorry. First call the roll. I get used to Ways and Means. I don't have to go through.
Senator Castillo?
Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye. Motion carries. Senator Duncan, did you say you would?
Yes, sure.
Okay, Senator Duncan will carry SGR 40, and that will conclude the work session on Senate SGR 40. And I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 977. Senator Shields.
Want to go out there?
Yes, that's fine. We'd like to look at you up in front of us now.
Again, I want to apologize for being late. It's just impossible to be in two committees at once. And we were fighting over some big bills down in Streams and Hanson as well this morning, so my apologies. For the record, last time I checked, I was State Senator Frank Shields from Senate District 9. I'm still relatively sure that I am this morning. With regard to Senate Bill 977, this legislation stems from the training on brain research that Oregon's Child, Everyone's Business campaign presented in January. As I sat and listened to the compelling findings on the brain, I was fascinated. A child is born with 100 billion brain cells. The connections of these brain cells occur after birth. These connections happen rapidly and are absolutely dependent on love, nurturing, and stimulation that the child receives. The simple fact is that a child who is loved and nurtured has a brain that is 30% larger than a child that does not. The other compelling finding stems from pictures of the brain. New technologies through PET, positron emission tomography, shows how the brain uses energy. And I find this really fascinating. We can now see the difference between an active stimulated infant's brain and a deprived infant's brain. The not active part of the brain looks pale, while the stimulated parts of the brain are colored, I should say, a bright red. You'll be receiving written copies of my testimony and some graphs and stuff, I think, in a few seconds here. The pictures amaze me. And I still remember seeing them on the big screen over at Willamette University. The pale part of the brain just, you know, showed that the child was not stimulated at all. And then there's this bright part of the brain. Equal to my fascination, however, was my frustration. We need to be doing more. Senate Bill 977 is part of a legislative package that I've put together to incorporate the recent brain research findings that we have into public policy. Senate Bill 977 addresses a critical issue that we cannot ignore. Children raised in deprived environments end up compromised. That is the honest truth. As a policymaker, I cannot ignore this. And we as a legislative body must not turn away from the facts that are presented to us. Craig and Sharon Ramey reported in the National Health Education Consortium in an article, quote, "At risk does not mean doomed," findings from a long-term study that addresses interventions for children who are environmentally at risk. Ramey had two groups, an experimental group and a control group, and I want you to listen to the differences between these groups. Both groups had mothers with developmental disabilities. The experimental group received quality child care from as early as 6 weeks of age, full day, 5 days a week, 50 weeks per year in an early childhood program. The control group received supplemental medical, nutritional, and social services, but did not receive the early education program. The 41 children received the early education program all tested normal in intelligence by the age 3. In contrast, all but one of the 45 children in the control group, remember, that still had the good nutrition and stuff, had IQs in the mental retardation or borderline mental retardation range. This research gives us critical information about what is an effective intervention. The research showed that for children in very deprived environments, that early education is the only factor that can prevent mental retardation. Home visiting services may be helpful to the parents, but they do not raise the children's IQs. Senate Bill 977, with the proposed amendments, creates a flexible pool of money in the child care division. The funding can be accessed through local planning applications or through individual professionals working with families that fit the criteria. If we had a comprehensive early childhood system that included universal screening, early head start, and family relief nurseries that met the need, we wouldn't need this bill. But our system, as it is, does not adequately address this population. There is a gap in our service delivery system. The bill addresses that gap in a flexible way that will meet individual needs. We cannot afford to turn our backs on this population. The fiscal, underlying fiscal, and human cost is just too great. The increased cost of the state due to special education and increased need for public service cannot be ignored. But the greater need is to prevent a compromised life. The increased potential of a child cannot be ignored. Once we become aware of interventions that are there, we must not turn our back. We as policymakers have a responsibility to promote fiscally sound public policy that truly makes a difference in maximizing the potential of a child's life. As I said a few minutes ago, I still feel like I'm underwater down in the Streams Enhancement Committee, but I'd be glad to try to shift gears and answer questions if you have them. I think you have some experts around here that might do a better job of that, however.
Senator Shields, we have a Dash 1 amendment.
I don't have it in front of me. I'm sorry.
Have you had a chance to look at it, then?
Yeah, I believe so, and I have staff that can help me. Need to sit down here. Why don't you introduce yourself and talk about it?
For the record, my name is Sonia Fish, and I'm staff to Senator Shields.
I just really wanted to know if you had a chance to look them over enough that you were acquainted with them, and if it was your recommendation that we consider the Dash 1 amendment.
Yeah, really.
Yeah. Senator Fisher, I worked with Pam Curtis from the Governor's Office, the Commission on Children and Families, the Employment Department, the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Council in drafting these amendments towards the bill, so it's been a comprehensive process.
I have to say, Senator Fisher, that I have a great deal of confidence in Sonia to handle this kind of stuff, and I've just been so buried in my other four committees that I haven't done as much as I should have myself, but I kept tabs on her as she met with these various groups.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm just saying, the research is overwhelming, I think. I think if we don't act now, we're harming a lot of young children. I'm excited about this. It's interesting to note that being an educator isn't just educators doing good or feeling good about things. This is the scientific research of the medical field. I have a person I know well is a University of Portland graduate who's now is one of the nation's leaders in brain research, University of San Francisco Medical School, and neurologists and so forth. They're all saying the same thing. This is really important. I think we need to be moving forward with due haste.
Well, if you go back to my original example with the 41 kids in the early education program and the 45 that didn't get it, think about the cost of the 45 mentally retarded kids throughout a school lifetime experience. And that's just one experiment. That was a scientific experiment.
Yes, that made me think how unfair it was for those other kids.
Yeah.
I mean, I was thinking, my gosh, they're guinea pigs.
You have to do the research.
And you have to have the research.
And the government, the feds, often require that kind of control group. We've done it in our welfare programs and a lot of other places. We've done it with Steps to Success. I can remember that discussion in Ways and Means sub on Human Services a few years ago. I always felt so bad for those that were in the control group.
Yeah. We also, we don't want to forget the fact that the prenatal and all of those things.
Yeah.
So what is it? They say birth 18 months, even with that brain research is so
important. Yeah. I don't want to belabor the fact that some of the findings across the street that were presented at the symposium, a child is actually ready for interactive communication by the time they reach 18 weeks of age. That doesn't mean they have language, but they're ready for interaction between parent, mother, father, child. They're ready to respond. They're ready to communicate in their own way. And the brain cells and the synapses are developing like crazy at that point in time, and we ignore that with our traditional system of education. And that's why some of these non-stimulated infants were so retarded at such an early age.
Mm-hmm.
How do you plan to carry this out?
Senator Fisher, Senator Cannon, the Employment Department is here to talk about the specifics of the bill, but the proposed amendments basically create a flexible pool of funding in the child care division, which can be accessed through local bodies applying for funds or for individual professionals working with individual families applying for funds. The attempt was to make the pool as flexible as possible to meet the individual needs of families. The employment department, the child care division, would set up the necessary rules and eligibility criteria to implement the actual program. But the intent is to fill a gap in the service delivery system where there is not available service for this population.
Can I continue your response first?
Please answer both of these. Because these developmentally, mentally, emotionally people have been up here often saying our kids have been removed. And maybe you established a gap before I arrived, but taking people's children, I'm not sure how this works. And it's already not perfect.
Senator Fisher, Senator Shannon, the intent is not to take the children. The intent is to provide supportive services for the family so that the child will receive the intellectual stimulation that the child needs. For children that are being, that are in protective services, this does not apply to them. This is for loving, caring parents that simply do not have the intellectual capacity to provide the intellectual stimulation the child needs to develop normally.
And who decides this?
There are a number of services that that go to the family. Community health nurses interact with these families. Healthy Start workers work with these families. There are a number of professionals along the continuum of early childhood.
Time, but Senator, isn't it? It's my understanding that when these home visitors come in, that those people like this, that might be just a little slow, those kids go at the top of the list anyway. These are the ones that are identified. Like we only do 15% of the kids, 50% of the kids on Head Start. Those are the ones that are in there first, and the others that have what you deem officially mental, okay, or without the emotional, they're on a waiting list. But these kids that are at the highest risk are already in there.
Yeah, Chair Fisher, Senator Shannon, that is true. For the home visiting services, that is true. What the research has shown, which is where you walked in when Senator Shields was giving his testimony, is that home visiting services for this population is not enough. Children in the control group that received home visiting services at the time of 3 years of age had mental retardation versus a control group of children that received quality child care at 3 years of age did not have mental retardation. Children, absolutely, families of this population do need the home visiting services, but the children need an early education program to maximize
the result of
potential.
One more, Senator. Yes. The result of this home service is just to get them the service, not just have a lady come in and say, you're not doing enough. And these kids are already at the top of every list, whether it's intervention for their own problems, whether it's early healthy start, early, and all that. And I have a little concern is because the children, I'm not sure I want to give them any more money because they want in the school. And already, if they have these little, daycare centers or what, that they're wanting to put them into our kids' schools, which are for after-school activities. And, I'm a little concerned about more money for the children, commission, and families when they want to take over the school.
Chair Fisher, Senator Shannon, the intent is to not to create any service to fill a gap where existing services do not meet the need. And just for clarification, the funding would be with the child care division as a flexible pool of money, not through the local commission on children and families. The bill has been amended.
Okay, I'd like to see some of these kids that are absolutely qualified but not being serviced right now. It's incredible that early kids that have the services, that how our state's doing a great job. I'd just like the names of some that are qualified from the visit and are not being serviced.
Chair Fisher, I can absolutely get you some of those families that adults are being served through the developmental disabilities programs and the children do not receive service.
And
James Pays is here, and he can speak to that.
Sure.
Can I come back up there and let some other people, a better expert than me?
Well, we have Dennis Lubbock and Tom Olson and Annette Elderson.
Mr. Chair, would you like to
all come
up together?
Certainly.
I know that.
Well, we want to proceed along as quickly as we've got a heavy agenda.
Okay, I'm going to go first. Thank you. Senator Fisher and distinguished committee members, my name is Janice Lubbock. I really appreciate having the opportunity to give some support to Frank Shields, Senate Bill 977, which would provide flexible funding for children who live in at-risk environments. I'm the program manager at Pearl Buck Center's Families with Special Needs Preschool Program in Eugene, Oregon. I appreciate having the opportunity to tell you the importance of providing a safe and nurturing and stimulating environment for children whose parents have mild developmental disabilities or have mental health issues. I don't want to say too much about the brain research, but I do want to reiterate a few things. Those of us who work with young children have felt for a long time what brain research has finally proved for us. The period of early childhood from conception through at least age 3 is critical in a child's development. The experiences of infant and young child of the young child provide the foundation for long-term physical and mental health as well as cognitive development. A child's brain reaches 90% of its adult size by the age of 3. Changes in the brain occur not from new brain cells, but from the growth of the cells that are already present. How does this happen? This happens through seeing to our children, to reading books to infants and toddlers, to talking with the baby, from making eye contact, from saying nurturing words, with playing with the baby. All of these seemingly simple acts help a child's brain cells grow. This is a time of both opportunity and vulnerability for the child. For parents with developmental disabilities or mental health issues, providing the necessary stimulation the infant and toddler needs to grow and learn is very challenging. This is a time when a child develops attachments to others and learns to regulate their emotions, as well as they learn critical language, motor, and cognitive skills. Without intervention, these children are at risk of developing what is referred to as environmental retardation. It has the same lasting impact as if a child was born with such a disability. Children enter our preschool, which is accredited by the National Association for Education for Young Children, at the age of 2. We feel that this is late. If we had our best of all possible situations, we would begin seeing the children in a structured environment at the time that, of birth. For some of the children, we notice delays when they come to us at the age of 2, particularly in the areas of emotional development, social skills, and language and speech development. All of the children who enter our program are screened by staff from the Early Childhood Coordination Assessment Referral Services in Wayne County. If a child is identified with delays in areas of development, particularly if it's in all areas, they're referred to programs who serve children with developmental disabilities. Each year, one or two of the children who have more general cognitive development, normal cognitive development, are identified to have some delays in speech and language. We also find children who have hearing losses because they have not been treated for middle ear or inner ear infections. We also have found children who have vision problems that we can get them the necessary correction so that they continue to grow and develop. Children attend our preschool, the young children who are 2 and 3, 2 days a week from 9 until 2. Transportation is provided, meals are provided. When a child is 4, they begin attending the program 4 days a week. Our goal is to prepare the children for successful transition into regular kindergarten program. And to this date, we've been successful to about 98% of the children. We're also, our goal is to help the parent families to stay intact. We do that through case management services. I've received calls from Douglas County and Jackson County where human service workers have identified parents with developmental disabilities struggling to parent their child. Support is needed for these children, most of whom are not eligible for funded services. There is no funding mechanism in place to provide the intensive, ongoing support these families and the children need. Our program is partially funded by United Way of Lane County, but relies heavily on foundation grants and private donations. We receive a small amount, about 4% of our budget, from the Human Services Commission in Lane County. These parents live at or below the poverty level, and they're unable to access child care or preschool services for children that their children need because they don't have the funding to support that. So I urge you to support Senator Shields' bill to provide a flexible funding mechanism which would allow these children to receive the critical stimulation they need. Money spent, we've said this and it cannot be said enough. At this point, when the children are young, we'll come back to our communities many times over as we nurture the development of intelligent, caring, and contributing members of our community. Thank you. I'm open to any questions.
We ask you to keep it as short as possible and acknowledge support and bring in extra news.
Mr. Chair, Members, Annette Talbot, Legislative Coordinator for the Employment Department, with me as Tom Wilson, the Administrator of the Child Care Division. We appreciate the opportunity that Senator Shields has presented the Child Care Division with the Dash 1 Amendment. We very much believe that we could play a valuable role in administering this flexible fund. We believe that the preventative nature of making sure these children do receive this type of care so that they don't become developmentally disabled is consistent with the state strategy and delivering care for children. And we do have a strategy that also seeks to assisting disabled children themselves. So we hope that this would prevent spending more money on that strategy if we prevent that up front. And I will ask Mr. Olson if you have any additional comments. We do know you have a floor agenda.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom Olson, Administrator of the Child Care Division. I just want to say that I really appreciate seeing these bills come out in this session. This is, I think, some of the most valuable discussion that we can have in the state of Oregon on the future of our children, the future of our families. This bill clearly recognizes the importance of the brain research in the development of children. And it also, I think, for the first time, we're recognizing that child care is, in fact, early childhood education. It is not babysitting. And what happens in child care and quality child care is possibly one of the most important preventative measures that we can take in the state of Oregon to prevent tragedies happening like this, the horrible tragedy in Colorado. Those types of things can be prevented at the earliest stages of life when children are very, very young. And this bill addresses that type of a situation, and it addresses the preventative measures that we need to take in the state to make sure our children and families are healthy.
How much money are you looking for?
Senator Fisher, members of the committee, we have not determined a fiscal impact on this.
Well, there definitely will be a fiscal impact, and we need to have something to shoot for.
I just want to say something here. I have a son, 32 years old, and I don't mean to be the Lone Ranger here, but I want to know where you guys stand. I learned about this before he was born. I knew he had to crawl before he walked if he was going to read. We read all this in Reader's Digest. I mean, to come and say this is brand new and this thing that you went through, we have known about, I knew that if I didn't pick him up when he cried, I read it in Reader's Digest. If you don't pick them up when they cry, that's where they get their self-esteem. You pay attention to them. You leave them alone, and they don't. I mean, this to say this is brand-new brain research, and therefore we have to have it, I knew it was before I gave birth to all three of my kids. It was in the public domain. And the other thing I want to know, we have no evidence that those boys that did that on Wednesday when or Tuesday were not graduates of Head Start. We do not know what services that they have been exposed to. So to say it would be prevented just by more of this, and I know people right now in my community that they work, he's a builder, she works in a beauty shop. Their kids are in invention. They had a child. They qualified. There's a great intervention already going. That he was deaf. I don't understand who's not being serviced.
Well, yeah, when you ask that question, it's real interesting to me. In Lane County for next year, I have already on the wait list 14 children to enter the two-year-old classroom. That's 14 families that have been identified by people who work with them. Primarily my referrals come from people who access WIC, also from developmental disabilities caseworkers. So I'm not sure who you're referring to that are not accessing services, and what those services
are. I think they're getting services.
Where? There are no early intervention services for these families. Head Start doesn't start until the age of 3. These children need intervention before the age of 3. We're doing great to see the child at the age of 2. We should be seeing the child at the age of 6 months, if not 6 weeks. And so I think your comment about having read, and you knew intuitively, you knew.
No, I didn't.
With your child,
it's all the research. They have to crawl.
But what is new about what's happened is that the research was based on our observations, and they were very valuable and very important. What's critical about what's happened with the brain research now is, for the very first time, we have the technology that demonstrates what is actually happening in the brain that we knew by what we observed, but we could never prove. And now it's been proven, what we have all, as parents and educators, have known for a number of years.
Bring up that research and show it.
Yeah. I know we need to move on. I just think that there is so much. We have to be very careful, I think, dealing with our own situation. We're talking about a lot of different people and a lot of different things in society. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people aren't even reading Reader's Digest.
No.
Don't buy that.
You can't read.
You know, I just think that obviously we've not been doing it.
Right.
Not being done. And you can see with the research that if you do it, the difference is going to be there. I just
give an anecdotal information. We had one parent who had 3 children, and 2 of them attended the preschool and are in regular class.
We have this in
your
written testimony.
Okay.
And I'm going to have to call a halt to this because we've got, I believe we have to do, and this is the last day we have with your bills and get them into the process. So I'm going to give it a few people about it. Appreciate your attendance, and we will probably visit this again, but I want some dollar figures available to me at that time. Public hearing on Senate Bill 977 and open the public hearing. And I think I'm going to take 684 and Senate Bill 708 at the same time here and open public hearing on both of them because several people are coming to talk on both of them. So I will open those public hearings right now. Sandra Bishop, Gary Eager, and Richard Bart. Either of Sandra Bishop, Gary Eager, or Richard Barter here. If you wouldn't mind coming and get started, so we don't have to wait. Public hearings on both bills at the same time, so we have another issue that we need to deal with here today also, that people have come from a long distance, so we need to get going.
Thank you, Senator Fisher. Chair Fisher, for the record, my name is Sandra Bishop, I'm representing today the Fair Competition Alliance. I know you have a session very soon, and I'll just try to summarize the... Actually, I think the easiest thing to do would be to start with one door at a time. We're basically... I'll start with Senate Bill 684. There's an extensive amendment to this bill. And this, the import of the amendment is the -1 amendment, and they were just released from Legislative Council. Thank you. And I don't even have a copy of them yet, but I can tell you what they do. We've been working on them extensively. They do only two things. Number one, they put a definition of disabled into ORS 279.835, and this is the public contracting law, which was passed in 1977 in Oregon. This mandates that all public contracts go to nonprofit organizations if they are employing the disabled to complete the work or provide the services under those contracts. This is a mandate not only for state agencies, but also for all political subdivisions and all public entities in the state. So your local public utilities or municipal utilities, school districts, anyone who puts out a contract has to go through this process. And that's the main thing, that the word severely is put in the statute. Right now, there is no definition in ORS 279 for purposes of interpreting this contracting law. I have, just for you to see, I'm not going to give you copies of this, but this is one document of one bit of research that we did when we searched the administrative rules and the ORS for definitions of disabled. There's no scarcity of definitions of disability. In the ORS, there are about 26 different definitions. In the Oregon Administrative Rules, there are some 70 definitions. So we felt that it was not improper or, you know, out of line to be asking for a definition in a program like this where so many public dollars go, and where the purpose of the statute is to employ the severely disabled. And the reason we've put in definitions is because over time, the program has evolved in such a way that the number of disabled individuals with severe disabilities seems to be declining as the large corporate nonprofits continue to get larger and larger dollar volume contracts. We're not talking about insignificant amounts of money here. We're talking about $1 and $2 million janitorial contracts. We're talking about corporate nonprofits that send out 1,500 temporary service workers and claim that they are disabled. But when you ask anyone within the community of the rehabilitation centers, it's difficult, if not impossible, to get them to give you a definition of disability because it's not written in the statute. So that's what we've done. And the choice of disabilities that we put in the statute in the -1 amendment are about 3 or 4 categories of benefit, eligibility for categories of benefit. So we're not attempting to come up with a comprehensive, exclusive list saying a certain type of disability is in and a certain type is not. What we're trying to do is look at categories of disability. Just to cut to the bottom line, what we are trying to avoid is someone like myself, you know, who goes to the doctor this afternoon because of wearing glasses, be able to be declared to be disabled and then go into one of the temp service positions in a nonprofit. So, and that's a very extreme example, but I think we need to look at it, and it's really going to be up to the committee to decide where to draw the line. I think this issue of definitions is going to look very much, I'll just use this analogy, you don't want to be reminded of it, but I use the analogy of the Oregon Health Plan. You have a certain number of services, and you draw the line as to what services are covered. What we're asking you to do is look at the categories of definitions and you draw the line at what type of disabilities you want under this protected status.
Sandra, mm-hmm. This is a situation here where you basically replaced the bill with 684-1.
Right, that's correct.
I'm going to close the public hearing on 684, and we're not going to deal with that today. People haven't had a chance to look at it. There's no sense in just getting up there and taking time on something that nobody's seen, and we don't know exactly how it fits. So we will come back and visit that on another day, and I'm going to close the public hearing portion on Senate Bill 684.
I'm only concerned that there might be some people with disabilities or something I see the room for.
I understand, and most of them we have down over here on the other side, 708. It's just one of those unfortunate things. I wasn't aware that you're Act 1 amendments were so inclusive, and nobody else had a chance to study them. There's no sense in coming here and presenting things on things that nobody knows what's going on with. So go ahead and concentrate on Senate Bill 708. Please make it as brief and concise as you can.
Yes, I will. Senator Fisher, members of the committee, I appreciate that. We didn't know when those Act 1 amendments were coming out either. Let me go ahead and go to Senate Bill 708, and I'll go ahead and pass out copies of this list. This is and actually someone has gone to get Senator George. This is Senator George's bill, and he's in Ways and Means and would like to speak on it when he can get back. This bill, Senate Bill 708, makes a simple change in the statute, the same statute, which is the 279.835 through 279.855. This is the public contracting using the disabled to produce the work under contract. What this 708 does is simply says that for purposes of measurement, there's a provision, one of the main provisions under the statute is that 75% of the direct labor is to be done by people with disabilities, as disability is defined or interpreted under this law. And this simply says that that 75% should be measured per contract rather than per or throughout an organization. So that gets to the point of the two. Or at 279.835 is an employment statute. The express purpose is to create jobs for people with disabilities. It doesn't make sense. I'm really summarizing. I'm on about page 4 of the written. It doesn't make sense to argue that non-disabled labor should be used on contract if they're procured under this statute, which expressly is to increase job opportunities for the disabled. So it's a very simple change, but it is a much needed clarification so that you can be assured and everyone can be assured that people with disabilities are actually getting these jobs.
Could you pass out these notes, Sandy? Did you have them? We have some notebooks with a lot of background materials for people. There are some very interesting documents in here. I'm sorry, you don't have these yet. There's a memo in here that was written to Representative Jane Loken during the interim, and it captures the period of time from July 1997 through June of 1998. In that time period, Department of Administrative Services, whose job it is, this is under number 16 when you get the notebook, let me back up a little bit. It's the Department of Administrative Services who has the responsibility for implementing and enforcing this public contracting system. The requirement is that 75% of the direct labor be done by the disabled. So in July of 97, DAS officials say, oh, we always measure it per contract. In February of 98, they say, no, it's organization-wide. And a week later in February, they say, oh, no, it's per contract. In June of 98, an attorney general's opinion comes out that says it's organization-wide. You can see the need for it. There's other documents in here that relate to the fact that some of the places are not apparently using direct labor. One of the main things that goes to show that are under tabs number 20 and tabs number 21 are specific instances of abuse of the system by some of the larger private nonprofits, showing that there are actually employees who are claiming, some under legal oath, that they are not using 75% to produce the work on some contract. And there's various other documents, but I'll just stop there for that. What my testimony is about under first 10708 is actually about, I hesitate to say this, but it has a lot to do with who you are as legislators and who the Attorney General is. And I hope that you will take time to read this. It took a lot of research for me to prepare this testimony. I usually don't prepare quite this well. The Attorney General's opinion that came out was published 2 days before someone from Department of Administrative Services had to testify during the interim. And that testimony is very, that opinion is very, very weak. The cases that are cited, a lot of them were later overturned. It's not based on logic. It was done by someone who is not an attorney, it appears. It was done by someone that is perhaps a first-year law student in that office. And just what I want to leave you with today is that the departments of the state are who the Attorney General is the attorney for.
Yes, sir. Another question. I was reading what you were saying. The Attorney General signs all opinions coming from their office. I mean, backs up every opinion, right?
Senator Fisher, Senator Duncan, I don't know the procedures in the,
well, the Attorney General.
Attorney General's office to answer.
In other words, there's always an opinion from the Attorney General. And I guess what I'm saying is you're making reference to a law clerk, I mean, even the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court uses law clerks. I mean, that's just very, I'm sensitive with what the concern is. The Attorney General signs off on it. That's good enough for me. Go ahead.
Chair Fisher, Senator Duncan, what I'm about to tell you, and I think it's a very important point, is that as legislators, the Attorney General is not your lawyer. The Attorney General is the lawyer for the executive branch and the departments of state government. But as legislators, you set policy. You're not required to follow Attorney General's opinions. That's my whole point. And especially not an opinion that was rushed through as, you know, a last-minute effort before a hearing. And I think that if you refer back, there is a legislative council opinion behind number 17. This was issued a year earlier, in July of 1997. The Attorney General's opinion we're talking about is behind 18, tab 18, and it came out in June of 98. The legislative council opinion has a little bit more substance to it, but it's not a decision that the Attorney General can make for you. What we're saying is that you as legislators need to make a decision about how that measurement should be made, and that you're not required to follow the Attorney General's opinion.
Well, I've also put on record that the federal employees didn't necessarily follow the Attorney General's opinion. I'm not sure if it wasn't good enough for them, but it's good enough for us. But in any event, there's been more than one place where they've been wrong. And attorney generals of both parties, so it's not a partisan effort. This is a bipartisan thing that we always face. But, we need to hurry on here, so you can see we're not going to be able to cover this in the depth that we need to cover it in today, and so perhaps we can just allow people to get the basics down and go ahead with it, but we're not going to be able to follow through on a blow-by-blow on notebook of this.
Chair Fisher, senators on the committee, we simply give you the notebook for future reference. We've testified several times during the interim. We have been accused of unsubstantiating you know, having unsubstantiated accusations, this kind of background material will give you some idea of the kind of research, careful research we've done and some of the abuses. So I would especially draw your attention to number 20 and 21. Those are examples of abuses. If it's possible, I'd like just to be able to have the people that have come today from the Alliance be introduced or take a few minutes.
Thank you, Senator Fisher. Distinguished senators. As a small local business owner and employer of several individuals with disabilities, I'm Sherry Egger from the Fair Competition Alliance. As a small local business owner and employer of several individuals with disabilities, I recognize and appreciate the importance of providing meaningful employment and opportunities to all individuals. My first encounter with the Products of Disabled Individuals Law was in 1994 when my firm was not selected for mailing services by the Secretary of State's office, even though I was low bidder on a contract. Questions to state officials, legislators, and other individuals yielded little clarification, only more questions. When I queried a local legislator about this law, he explained that he would introduce me to my competitor and let them explain to me why they should have this advantage. Over time, it has become clear that this issue is much larger than simply competition in the mail services industry or in my goal to grow a small, successful company. It is about ensuring that the Products of Disabled Individuals Law is managed and monitored in a fair, equitable, and understandable manner. After 5 years of research, it is clear that in order to address the interests of all stakeholders, clarification of the current Products of Disabled of Individuals Law is necessary. The Fair Competition Alliance was formed over a year ago and is a group of business owners and operators dedicated to fairness and equity in public contracting in Oregon while protecting and enhancing employment opportunities for the severely disabled. Since November of last year, I've participated in the task group on QRF reporting, which was created at the suggestion of Representative Loken. And includes Oregon Department of Administrative Services, the Fair Competition Alliance, Oregon Rehabilitation Association, and various QRF representation. The purpose of this task group is to review ODAS reporting and record-keeping requirements for ORS 279.835 through 279.855. As we're not going to discuss Senate Bill 684, I want to focus in on a major issue.
Can you do that in about 2 minutes?
I'm going to do it, Senator Fisher. One of the big statements every time we run across comparisons between the state of Oregon 279.835 and the federal laws, the Javits-Gardner O'Day Act, is that those laws are comparable and similar in nature. In your packet, you'll find in item number 14, you'll find a federal-state comparison. And five of the major differences are distinct. One is the definition of disability. The federal clearly uses severely versus fully competitive employment. Another is the lack of determination of competitive employment by the state law. The third is the very severe difference, distinct difference, in terms of how the procurement list is generated and in the suitability procedures. And specifically in state, there is a total lack of the determination of suitability for individual products and services. And the fifth major item is clearly the lack of an impartial administration of the state law. Other items in the packet, item number 12, which include a niche first aid kit, clearly shows that although the federal law is not administered on a per contract basis, that is, the organization is evaluated overall, there are specific contract requirements. I urge the committee, in closing, to ensure that hopefully we can ensure to all stakeholders that the targeted population is really being served by not only the 279.835, but by all the activities of the administration of the Department of Administrative Services. Thank you.
I
just with money in the field company, president of Clayton Ward Recycling Company, which is a family-owned private for-profit company that's been operating in Salem area for about 30 years. I urge you to support 708. Looking back, I was involved when the original bill was passed to provide the subsidy for the non-profit. At the time, the idea was to help the folks who were, there was no way to be involved in private enterprise of any kind, and it's been corrupted over time by the large nonprofits to include people who have hay fevers, bad backs, flat feet, etc. And that certainly wasn't the intent by any means. What happened is in the state, the DAS has lost control, who's supposed to be the oversight, they've lost control of this. They don't police it by their own admission. They don't police it. They need seven more people to even think about policing the nonprofit. They don't pay any attention to it. They don't even make them fill out their forms correctly when they're applying for the aid. So there needs to be some, this 708 or 708 would bring at least some target line for gas to administer and to pay attention to, because they definitely aren't doing it today. Mm-hmm. Don't have any intention of doing it under the existing situation. Thank you.
Chair Bishop, for the record, behind number three is a population study, and I forgot to mention that. That relates directly to the definition. That's a population study from Portland State University Population Center for Population. Thank you, sir.
I want to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 708. I'm going to start it up again later on, but we've got some folks here that are from out of state to travel here on another bill, and we're going to spend some time on that, and then I'll release, we've got a caucus coming up at 8:45, and a 9:45, excuse me, and I'll go ahead and stay, and as long as I can, and listen to some of the further testimony here on record here, because we will be having another hearing on Senate Bill 708 and Senate Bill 634. Senator George, could I prevail on you to come back at another hearing rather than...
You're going to call me when you want it back.
Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 824. And I call Lisa William, Dr. Gary Kay, Dr. Charles Wagner. Go ahead, Lisa.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lisa Scott Gilliam. I am here today representing Sharon's file in support of Senate Bill 824. Senate Bill 824 is a very short, simple bill that lists prior authorization for non-sedating antihistamines and nasal inhalers. These medications treat the symptoms suffered by patients with asthma, sinusitis, and rhinitis, all of which are covered by the Oregon Health Plan prioritized list. Senate Bill 824 does not ask for an exception to conditions that would not otherwise be treated by OHP physicians. We are simply asking to be a part of the process rather than be forced outside the system. The way prior authorization works is this. If a patient's diagnosis is below the reimbursement line on the prioritized list, the drug will not be paid by OMAP. If the diagnosis is above the line, a special request is required for payment. This creates a powerful deterrent to doctors because the process is complicated and time-consuming, and Dr. Charles Wagner, a Salem allergist and the current president of the Western Society of Allergy, will address this in more detail in a few minutes. I'd like to show you the OMAP prior authorization request forms. The only other drugs listed are weight reduction, antifungals, and anti-ulcer therapy. It's a very limited list, and the justification for listing medications that relieve the very real suffering due to chronic allergies and the more serious ancillary problems
that arise from improper and inadequate treatment. You all know someone who suffers from allergies. It's a very real problem that in many cases requires medical attention and the best medications available to relieve suffering and make sufferers more productive at work and school. Currently, OMAP patients use over-the-counter medications such as Benadryl. I have a box of Benadryl and I have a box of Sominex to show you that the sedating medication in Sominex appears in Benadryl in the same dosage. It's, for both of them, it's 25 milligrams of diphenhydramine, and it's in both of these medications. So children on the Oregon Health Plan are being given antihistamines with the same dosage as an adult sleep aid, and then are being sent off to school. These children, as well as most adults covered by the Oregon Health Plan, have many disadvantages, and sending them to work or school on a virtual sleeping aid only adds to their disadvantages. This shouldn't be a territorial battle for those who oppose this bill. In fact, this issue should be decided on the scientific and practical evidence that we're presenting today. To explain this in more detail, I would like to introduce Dr. Garrett Kay, the nation's leading expert on the effects of sedating antihistamines. Dr. Kay is the Associate Professor of Neurology and Psychology and Director of the Neuropsychology Division of Georgetown University School of Medicine in Washington, D.C. He is also the President of the Washington Neuropsychological Institute in Washington, D.C.
Members of the Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Gary Kay for the record, and today I'm coming here in support of Senate Bill 824. And I was impressed by the discussion of brain science and brain research so far, but also the committee's dealing with issues related to children's learning. And this certainly is an issue which will also relate to brain function and children's learning. Currently, the Oregon Health Plan forces people to use these first-generation sedating antihistamines. What I'd like to do is share with you as briefly as possible what is the medical research on the impact of these antihistamines on safety, learning, productivity, and performance. And I'd like also to let you know that there's an alternative to these medications, non-sedating antihistamines, that have no effects on mood or effects that are comparable to no medication, to placebo, in terms of their effects on mood, thinking, motor skills, and so forth, that are safe enough to even be approved for use by airline pilots and military pilots because of their safety profile. So I take you through the handout that was given to you. To use a good word from allergy, I'd like to sensitize you to these issues. First, I'd like to sensitize you to the fact that allergy is a common condition. That it's a condition that affects perhaps 20% of the population. And the effect that it has on people's lives is not trivial. If you look at the effect on quality of life, the effect is comparable to what you find with asthma. And nobody on the committee would consider asthma to be a trivial disease. But the effect on people's quality of life, the impact that it has on their lives, is comparable for seasonal allergic rhinitis, what we often call hay fever, and asthma. And asthma, allergy, have marked effects on brain function, manifest by changes in mood. They affect your learning, your motor skills, and in fact, there's a great deal of cost associated with these medications, and these cost, not medications, but cost associated with the allergy all by itself. Because the allergy all by itself, people are not able to function as well in their work and in their employment, in the classroom, just because of the allergy, before even the introduction of any kind of medication. It was important to treat this disorder. This disorder actually has a great deal of economic impact. If you turn to the page where it says, top effect of allergy and cognitive function, this is a study, again, independent of anything related to medication. If you look at the gray bars, that's the bars for people who have allergies. And it's showing you during the fall allergy season, people with allergies take more repetitions of a list of words to learn the list of words. If you repeat the same study, the same test with these people, when they're free of allergy exposure during the winter, they take less trials to learn the list of words. If you repeat this again in spring, again, they're back up to requiring more trials to learn a list of words. There's clearly a seasonal effect on learning, independent of any medication. It's the effect that allergy has on our brain functioning. If you treat the person for this disorder, for their allergic disorder, And as you can see, also during the non-allergy season, there's no difference between allergy sufferers and non-allergy sufferers in terms of their learning and thinking. So it's important to treat this disorder. It's a very treatable condition. What about sleep? This disorder also has a dramatic effect on sleep. 3/4 of people who suffer from allergy report disturbance of sleep. Disturbance of sleep means disturbance of wakefulness the next day. And again, think about the impact that has on our performance, productivity, classroom performance, etc. The first generation antihistamine came around 60 years ago. They were very potent drugs. They were very well at blocking the histamine reaction that caused the allergy symptoms. But these medications readily crossed into your brain. They didn't just treat your nose, the skin, the throat, the eyes. They also had an effect on the brain, which is not where you try to treat allergies. But they did affect the brain, and they knocked out the histamine system in the brain. The histamine system in the brain, to show you pictures of PET scans, for example, we can show you that 70% of the histamine receptors in the brain are occupied when you give somebody a drug like diphenhydramine, Benadryl. What are these drugs? They're drugs you know all too well. Diphenhydramine is seen in Benadryl or Xanax. Chlorpheniramine, the second most common, is chlortrimetone, same drug you find in Contact. Trifolidine is an Actifed, etc. These medications are sold over-the-counter, and in fact, in the United States, we have no non-sedating over-the-counter antihistamines. All of our non-sedating antihistamines fit in the next category, in the next page, which they are all second-generation antihistamines, and they are available only by prescription at this time in the United States. These drugs were designed to be as effective as the older antihistamines, but to not cross into the brain, and therefore to not cause the sedation that you see with the older class of medications. For the ones that are non-sedating, there is no warning you about drowsiness or use caution when driving or operating machinery. Now, what are these drugs? They're drugs like cefepime, which is the newest, which is called Allegra. Loratadine, you've heard of, is Claritin. Cetirizine is Zyrtec. Esomeprazole, Fitzmenol. And last one, their trifenidine. Celdane is no longer on the market, but was the first of the non-sedating antihistamines. Now I want to talk to you for just a moment about the impact that the sedating antihistamine has. Rather surprising. First of all, studies in Group Health Cooperative, Puget Sound, by Dr. Gilmore, an occupational medicine doctor, looked at a variety of classes of drugs, narcotics, antibiotics, sedative hypnotics people take for sleep, and he looked at sedating antihistamine. Of all of those classes of drugs, the one associated with the highest increased risk of a traumatic work-related injury was sedating antihistamine, a 50% increase. People who take these medications will go to work, they'll do their normal activities, they won't take precautions because they feel fine. They don't think that they're impaired. In fact, they are. There are studies that look at...
Is an antihistamine?
Yes, sir.
It is.
Okay. It is. And it was the one we used to send... I'm a consultant to NASA, and it's the one, in fact, we used to send with the astronauts up to outer space because at the time it was less sedating than drugs like Benadryl and chlorpheniramine. But now I'll show you some data that will surprise you about the drugs we sent to the moon in just about 2 seconds here. If you look at worker performance, something that I've done myself, you basically find that there is an effect on worker efficiency. Basically, there's even a new study done at MIT, for example, looking at the number of claim processors complete per hour. And when they've taken a sedating antihistamine, they completed 20% fewer claims per hour than when they were taking a non-sedating antihistamine, or for people who had no allergies and were not taking medication. Think about the cost, 20% decrease in worker productivity. Forget about the missed days of work. Just look at decreased efficiency at work or in the classroom when somebody takes a sedating drug. Next slide, next page is on school performance. Europeans got access to the non-sedating antihistamine several years before we did. My colleagues over there got to do the study first. What they did is they brought kids into a simulated classroom and taught them how to perform on a computer the simulated farm simulation task, and the kids had allergies, and they were given either Benadryl, placebo, or a non-sedating antihistamine that was given Claritin, and then the kids were brought back 3 weeks later when they were not exposed to any allergies at all, and they looked at their performance and how much they had learned, and the kids who had been given the sedating antihistamine, the Benadryl syrup, with 25 milligrams, performed significantly worse than the medicines that are non-allergic kids and the allergic kids treated with either placebo or the non-sedating antihistamine. So basically, it's a double whammy effect. The kids with allergies have an effect of the allergy on their learning, and on top of that, you're giving them a sedating antihistamine. What about driving performance? We study that by actually taking people into a laboratory or out on the road. In the laboratory, I use 18-wheel truck driving simulators. I take truckers, hire them for 2 weeks, they drive every day, and we look at their performance under various drugs, under alcohol, and we measure their ability to avoid accidents. But you can take people out, not in the U.S., in Holland, on the highway, give them a 100-kilometer route to follow on the highway, and you measure their weaving and their ability to maintain distance while driving on the highway. This is true. We don't do this in the U.S., but our federal government does pay a lot of money to this laboratory in Holland to do this research. They study narcotics, alcohol, whatever. When you look just at a drug, you see this one slide here, comparison of driving performance, if you find this one. This is a rather surprising piece of data, but one that's been repeated many times. If you look at drugs like trifenidine, which is feldane, loratadine, which is Claritin, there was no increase in weaving after the person took the drug, 1 or 3 hours. But the third set of bars says triprolidine. That's the antihistamine in, as Senator Duncan asked, in Actifed. And with that particular drug, triprolidine, at the 10-milligram dose, the impact on driving was equivalent to what you find at a 0.05 blood alcohol level. Now, let's assume a person goes out and has a beer or two. A beer or two isn't necessarily going to raise you to a 0.08 level of blood alcohol. It's not going to make you, you know, driving impaired, according to the statute. But if you've had those two beers and you've had that on top of this triprolidine, your driving will be impaired beyond perhaps even the 0.10 level. And that's perhaps the reason why 35 states and the District of Columbia actually make it illegal for you to drive having taken any of these sedating medications, prescription or non-prescription sedating drugs, and then driving. How do we evaluate sedation? That's my job as a clinical neuropsychopharmacologist. I ask people, do you feel sleepy? I put electrodes on their head and I see if the brain is slowed down, and I give them performance tests, tests of their abilities. I put them in a simulator, that kind of thing. If I want to find out if they just feel sleepy, I can ask them or I can give them various kind of questionnaires like the ones that are shown on there. When you give a questionnaire, it's not surprising that the majority, you know, you do see an effect where people who've taken the sleeping, you know, drugs, the Benadryl here in this case, actually tell you that they feel fatigued. They tell you that they don't feel motivated to work. And they tell you that they don't feel that the quality of their work is very good. Okay? So that's self-report. That's just asking people. It's a very easy way to do data collection. But the fact is, you run into a little bit of a problem in that when you give people a 50 milligram dose of Benadryl, how many of them do you think tell you that they feel sleepy? Of 33 people. The reality was only 11 said that they felt sleepy. The other 22 did not feel sleepy. They didn't feel sleepy. They thought they'd gotten the placebo because nobody knew what drug they'd gotten. Well, the next table is one we just showed at the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. Rather surprising data. Public health issue here. People who took Benadryl, 22 people who did not feel sleepy, were tested. These 22 people who didn't feel sleepy were impaired on tests of divided attention, working memory, vigilance, and speed, even though they didn't feel sleepy. In fact, they were just as impaired as the 11 who knew that they were sleepy. Now, if on the next page I point out to you that if you don't know that you're sedated, you're not going to take precautions. You're not going to avoid operating that chainsaw. This would help explain why we look at the classes of drugs found on autopsies of dead pilots by the FAA in a 5-year period from 89 to 93. The number two drug you find in these dead pilots is, in fact, sedating antihistamine. Diphenhydramine, chlorpheniramine, bromphenaramine. Those are the three drugs we find, number two drugs. And believe me, student pilot, you don't get into a cockpit if you're feeling drowsy. But if you didn't feel drowsy, you wouldn't have avoided and you would have not failed to take the precautions. You can look at people's brain functioning from a drug by looking at how quickly they fall asleep. And the next chart simply shows that if you give chlorotrimetine, very, very common antihistamine, the night before, at 10 o'clock at night, and you measure the next day how quickly people fall asleep in the sleep laboratory, they fall asleep twice as fast as people given placebo. They fall asleep in 6 minutes, about like a patient with sleep apnea if they took it the night before. So, in fact, before the non-sedating antihistamines came along, that's how I was treated for my allergies. Take chlorotrimetine at night. Maybe the effects will wear off by the next day. Well, no. There is a significant hangover effect from that nighttime dosing. The last way to look at these drugs is simply to put somebody you know, in the simulator, have them drive the car on a 100-kilometer highway. And the abilities that you want to focus on are those which are most vulnerable to this class of drugs. And here are the three. Vigilance, which I know you're most concerned with, because vigilance is the ability to sustain your attention during a boring or monotonous activity. Not that you have
like hearing
a monotonous activity. But the reason why you're concerned with this is because it is considered by the NTSB to be the primary cause of accidents, collisions, whatever. It's the lapses of attention that people have, going through the red light, missing a signal, not monitoring something in their environment. Divided attention. People talking on the cell phone, driving at the same time, doing two simultaneous mental activities. The third is working memory, which is your ability to hold information temporarily in your head, like a telephone number when you call directory assistance. If you don't write it down, you're holding it in working memory. Very vulnerable to the effect of a sedating drug. These are critically important to daily life. And the fact is, I just showed you in a couple of subsequent slides, the test that I developed for the Federal Aviation Administration that's used by NATO air forces and by the Navy and by the Air Force and by many of the airlines around the world is called COGSCREEN. We use this test to test these abilities, the computerized test that measures very carefully levels of these abilities and can actually predict how well you're going to fly a plane and that can give you a divided attention test. Look up the computer if anybody wants to be tested on a break. But on the next slide, it basically just shows you after that first dose of Benadryl, any bar going down is deterioration. These are significant effects on mood, on speed, on working memory, on divided attention. And the last page just shows you the effect on vigilance. Basically, you find four times the number of lapses of attention when a person had taken the 50 milligram dose of Benadryl. Four times the lapses of attention. Now, to summarize, the sedating antihistamines have a negative effect on mood. You feel significantly more depressed and angry when you take these medications. You add that to the effect that the allergy has on your mood. You feel less alert, and you also have a significant effect, as I showed you, on cognition, which is thinking, psychomotor function, which is skilled motor activity. For example, on day 5 at 25 milligrams of Benadryl, 15% of the subjects crashed on our motor tracking test versus 0% on placebo, day 5. Okay? They interfere with productivity, basically a 20% cost in terms of the amount of work being completed. They interfere with safety, as I've shown you, 50% increase in worker-related injuries. They have effects that carry over to the following day, even if taken the night before. They cause impairment, even if you have no awareness that you might be sedated. And they disrupt activities in particular that involve divided attention, vigilance, and concentration. My recommendation is we need to avoid sedating antihistamines. We certainly can. We have a perfectly acceptable alternative. And we need to treat, as Dr. Wagner will be saying, we need to treat allergic symptoms early before they've affected brain function, and we can do that with a non-sedating antihistamine. So one last comment I would like to make is that with prior authorization, we basically have created a barrier for people in Oregon to access the non-sedating antihistamine. And we've also created a barrier to the treatment of these patients and the treatment of their allergies. And people taking the sedating antihistamines, the old antihistamines, have poor compliance. And with that poor compliance, you have a worsening of their health condition. And the long-range effect is that they then develop the sinusitis and other health problems that then cause them to take corticosteroids, systemic steroids, antibiotics. And so while you may have saved money in your antihistamine budget, you're hitting the budget in so many other ways. Through safety, impact on productivity, impact on performance, impact on children's learning, impact on the physician's time. And so I'm going to stop there and Dr. Wagner.
Chairman Fisher, distinguished members of the committee, it's my pleasure to be part of this. I've never been at one of these committee meetings, and so I've learned a lot already this morning. I'll make some brief comments. I appreciate the comments that Dr. Kay has made. I guess I'm going to give you the perspective of a practicing allergist. I've been in this area for 15 years, and so I get to see a lot of miserable people with allergies. I want to impress on you just how miserable these people are. I don't know if people really understand what the magnitude of the exposure to allergens in this valley is, but it's estimated that a single plant can produce as much as 1 million pollen grains in a given day. And when you look out in the valley and see all the grasses we have a tremendous amount of pollen in the air, particularly during the peak grass season. The grass season in this valley lasts somewhere between 6 and 8 weeks. And during that time, people really become non-functional. The problem from my standpoint is that if you can treat allergies early, you have a chance to prevent a lot of the problems that occur if the treatment is delayed. One of the problems with the currently available antihistamines for people under the Oregon Health Plan is that the side effects are so bad that either they feel worse when they take them, or they know they can't take them because if they want to get to their job and operate at heavy machinery, they know they won't be able to function properly. So we really impact the lives of these people who already are dealing with, I think, considerable psychosocial problems in a lot of cases. From my standpoint, for me to go through the process of trying to provide what I consider more appropriate medical care means that I have to have second visits with these people to prove that they have failed the traditional treatment. It means extra time in my schedule. It means extra time for my staff to prepare authorization for allowing them to have some of these other medications that I think are certainly more appropriate to be used. So I kind of think the other side of this from my standpoint is, as a specialist, I'm very aware of the research of Dr. Kay and some of these other people. For me to send somebody out the door with medications that I know put them in some jeopardy and may have adverse effects on their life doesn't put me in a great position. So anyway, I would urge you to support this bill.
Okay, thank you very much. Sure.
Senator Fishman, I have one quick question. Where does trimethoprim fall in this? That's my antihistamine drug of choice, and I don't see it anyplace.
Well, it indeed does have an antihistamine in it.
I mean a sleep inducement.
Yes. I think, you know, one of the ways that these medications have kind of gotten around is that they also put in decongestants, which tend to kind of worry you. And so you get sort of opposing effects so that maybe you don't feel like you're so sleepy, kind of what Dr. Kay was saying, and yet you probably are impaired.
It's kind of like having a martini and going to Starbucks and getting an espresso. Right? It doesn't completely reverse the effect.
I don't believe
not on Sunday.
Right.
When we give somebody a stimulating decongestant on top of their sedating antihistamine, they don't truly counteract one another, but you don't feel as sleepy. That doesn't mean that your performance is
going to happen. Okay. As allergy sufferer, though, a good night's sleep sometimes, my body heals itself.
Yeah, kind of like the average person, so that our beer makes you see double and feel single. I can help for one thing. I think the most miserable day I ever had sitting up here as a committee member was I'd been given the doctor's prescription Benadryl for me the night before. And I sat here, and I'm not kidding you, I was about ready to fall off this chair. I'd been headed to night. Mm-hmm. And then at one point, I thought I was going to have a stroke.
Oh, let's see. We need to hurry on. Bruce Crawford. Oh, Matthew. Thank you. Did a Bill Behrman wish to talk about this particular bill? Or was that a sign up for another one by mistake? And also a Frank Herring?
Sure, what am I supposed to do with that?
Of course, you're the only one here. But,
okay, what's your recommendation with the office? Do you want us to stay?
If you could stay maybe stay a few minutes here, I'll...
Okay. Mr. Carter, I can do this in about 2 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Hirsch Crawford, Director of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, and I'm here to oppose Senate Bill 8824. The plain language of the bill would prohibit OMAP from either withholding payment or requiring prior authorization for legend drugs, which fall into two different groups, either nasal inhalers or non-sedating antihistamines. And as was mentioned before, probably the two most common drugs which fall into this group are Claritin and Allegra. for the Oregon Health Plan, state statute currently requires that we use the prioritized list of services developed by the Health Services Commission and funded by the legislature in order to determine covered services under the health plan. Now, because the types of drugs that are affected by Senate Bill 824 are used to treat both covered and non-covered conditions, OMAP, we need to know what the patient's diagnosis is before we can make a decision on whether or not the drug is being prescribed for a covered condition. The types of conditions that are covered under the Oregon Health Plan for which these drugs would be approved are severe rhinitis, chronic severe runny nose, chronic sinusitis, sinus infections, inflamed sinuses, nasal polyps, which can close down your airways, or other nasal cavities or sinus conditions. But it's important to point out that non-covered conditions include simple seasonal allergies and non-severe rhinitis. So while I appreciate the testimony that's been presented on allergies, the fact is that simple allergies is a non-covered condition under the Oregon Health Plan. And the reason we have adopted our prior authorization requirements is so that we can identify prescriptions for simple allergies so that those prescriptions can be denied because the condition is not covered. Now, in terms of looking at the fiscal impact of the bill, in 1998, the review process denied approximately $800,000 in requests for prescriptions for conditions that are not covered under the Oregon Health Plan. If this bill were passed, those prescriptions would have been approved. The impact on the cost of the health plan in the 9901 biennium is approximately 1.7 million total funds, 700,000 general funds. And I need to point out one other issue with the way that Senate Bill 824 has been written. What it does is amend 414.325, which is a section of the ORS which impacts the fee-for-service portion of the Oregon Health Plan only. It does not affect the managed care piece of the Oregon Health Plan. So if 824 is passed, what it would mean is that we would have unlimited access to non-sedating antihistamines for people who are in fee-for-service. That's about 15% of our population. But we would continue to have limited access to non-sedating antihistamines for people who are in managed care. That's the other 85% of our population. The fiscal impact that I quoted a minute ago is based upon the bill the way it is written, which means that we assume an impact for the fee-for-service population. If the bill were amended so that it affects everybody in the Oregon Health Plan, those in managed care as well as fee-for-service, then the fiscal impact is going to increase significantly. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to try and answer your question.
Yes, Senator. Well, I guess the question I might have for you is he was commenting about offsetting. In other words, if you treat something now, you're going to, it's a preventative, if I heard it correctly, it's a preventative maintenance kind of a thing. Is that figured into your cost analysis?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, that is not. That is a line of logic that people talk about a lot when we're talking about limiting access to drugs. Typically, what you do is look at, say, the impact on other services and the types of really expensive services or hospital services. It's not clear that prescribing Claritin for somebody who has a simple allergy is going to reduce significantly other healthcare costs. It might bring it down some, but I think there still would be a net cost to the health plan if Senate Bill 824 passed.
Yeah, and that's always difficult for us. We always say our scope of practice doesn't really include all of this, and that it's difficult to make decisions sometimes. You heard the testimony we heard from the gentleman who's directly in the field. Gave us good advice from that standpoint, and then we have to make some decisions here. I guess based on what you heard too, you agree with what he was saying?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, I heard the testimony, and a large part of it simply argued for the fact that we ought to treat allergies appropriately and that these are good drugs to treat allergies. And I don't have any disagreement with that. But the issue is that the Health Services Commission decides what's covered under the Oregon Health Plan, and today, simple allergies are not a covered condition.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Steele.
That is my concern with having this bill before us. I very much appreciate the testimony we got from the doctor here, and he makes a great case for why these drugs are helping, can be very helpful to people, and I don't doubt the information that he presented to us. My concern is that we have a process for determining what's covered under the Oregon Health Plan, and the Health Services Commission is the one that oversees that. And so here we are being asked as legislators to go around that process and make a decision about this when this really, I feel like the presentation we had just before Hirsch got up here should have been made to the Health Services Commission, not us, so that they could determine whether or not they can fit this in, you know, on that list of services. And so I'm a little uncomfortable with using this process to determine what we're going to pay for under the health plan. Although I very much understand and appreciate getting this information about how these drugs can help people, I think definitely we need to take serious consideration of these.
Sure. I agree with this. Dr. Wagner, as I understand it, is a specialist and has people referred to him after they haven't been able to be taken care of in the regular course of business, which elevates them, my knowledge and judgment, into more or less of a condition that then would lend itself to fall into the severe laryngitis or whatever. I'm using the proper term. From that standpoint, then his testimony, if I understood it correctly, he has to mess around, waste his time trying to go through a process that doesn't help the people, that lends itself to have them getting worse when they've already probably gotten worse because they weren't treated properly to begin with, which ultimately raises the cost to the Oregon Health Plan, in my estimation. And now that he said you had to bring them back for a second visit in order to get rid of the requirements of and meet the requirements of elevating them to a drug to handle the case better. What's your assessment of that?
Mr. Chair, what complicates the factor here is that what is presented for coverage and payment to us is a prescription from a physician. The prescription doesn't include any information about what is wrong with the individual. All you have is a prescription for Claritin. And so in order for us to make a decision about whether or not it's being prescribed for a covered condition, steps have to be taken in order to find out what the diagnosis is. And we're willing to try and make that as simple as possible. It doesn't require a second physician visit, but we do need information from the physician as to the patient's diagnosis. And if the diagnosis is one of severe rhinitis or chronic sinusitis, then those are paid for.
Why is it so difficult? Does it require all this paper rigmarole and time for the doctor?
Mr. Chair, I don't think it requires a lot of paper processing. I think it requires information from someone in the physician's office. It can be either the physician or a nurse providing the diagnosis for the patient.
You heard the testimony from the man on the street doing the job. In order to get around the rules and regulations you have, he has to call people back after a certain length of time and have a second visit and go through a lot of the process to get this done. Now, does he or doesn't he?
Mr. Chair, I believe it can also be done over the phone.
Dr. Wagner, could you, he had to leave. Could you come back and answer the question here, because there seems to be some conflict as to the process in which you alluded to and which is being tried to answer.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I think the whole catch here is that you have to have certain severity criteria to be eligible to even apply for this, these kinds of medications. And I think that's the whole problem here. And what he is alluding to is that, I guess, he doesn't feel that these medications should be available for people unless they meet these severity criteria. And for us, you know, a lot of times that does mean a second visit. But at the minimum, it does mean we've got to fill out the paperwork, and especially this time of year, we are absolutely as busy as we can possibly be. And for us, that's an extra step, and what it means is a lot of times it just doesn't get done.
Is there any way of putting the diagnosis on a prescription as it's written, and so that it can go through, and taking care of that doesn't seem to be
pressing? I think so. Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware that, I mean, I think there is a form that has to be submitted specifically.
But he said they had to have a diagnosis. You didn't get it on the prescription. And I'm just saying, as a layperson looking at something and trying to cut out the process, is it impossible to write a diagnosis on the prescription? So when it goes in, they've got that information instead of having to fill out a whole other form?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure as far as the requirements, what would be allowable.
Mr. Chair, I would certainly be willing to look at the authorization process we have to see if there's any way to streamline that. I'm very sensitive to Dr. Wagner's concerns that we need to reduce the workload on physicians as low as we possibly can in this process. But what we simply need to find out is what, in fact, is the patient's diagnosis. And if there's an easier, simpler way to do that, I'll be glad to try to do that.
Do you have any idea or any speculation of perhaps what this process actually costs other agencies, like Health and Family Services, for people who are off work, that might cost vocational rehab and things for people that are having some of these things that can't function properly or be rehabilitated as soon as possible. I mean, it looks to me like there's a potential for a lot of other costs for other agencies.
Mr. Chair, I don't have that information.
Would it not seem reasonable that it could be a pretty extensive amount?
Mr. Chair, there could be some costs. But I need to go back to the point I made earlier, which is under the current set of statutes that determine the benefits under the health plan, we use the prioritized list, and the legislature decides where to draw the line on that list. And it currently is drawn at line 574. Simple allergies are on the list down at around 630, so they're significantly below the funded portion of the list.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, can I make a comment? I think the hard part is, from my standpoint, I don't see people with mild allergies. You know, I see people because their lives are being impacted. And so, from my standpoint, it is a big deal. It may not be quite as big a deal for people in the primary care field, although I think it really does impact them. But for me, it really does impact how I can care for people.
I have a big concern because as I look at the policies and stuff that I see OMAP projecting, the pre-authorization requirements and all this kind of thing, I see what I perceive to be a lack of much judgment on the part of OMAP in the making out of their budget and operating of their budget on what it affects in other departments. And is this true?
Senator Fisher, I have to come back to the criteria that we're statutorily charged with operating the health plan in such a way that we pay for covered services and do not pay for non-covered services. And the only way that we can do that around medications which are used both to treat covered and non-covered conditions is to find out what the patient's diagnosis is
And the only way to do that is to ask the physician.
And I'm saying, cannot the physician tell you when to write your prescription rather than him to take his staff's time and everybody else's time and the wait, because it looks to me like that this is interfering with the treatment of a patient that has gone beyond the initial stage of, and the primary care physician is looking to a specialist in order to treat this thing. And it is a seasonal thing, as was demonstrated here before, so that by the time he spends 6 weeks getting something ironed out and the permission to use it, the person has, the season is over or nearly over, and the whole thing is a nuisance. In the meantime, there's, from what I understand, some secondary things that happen to a person that plays around with these allergies over a period of time instead of getting them taken care of immediately. And perhaps Dr. Wagner could help me out a bit on this, because I'm not a specialist in that field, but certainly have read about it and studied on it to a certain extent.
Yeah, so I'll just briefly comment on that, Mr. Chairman. And I think there's no question that people with moderate to severe allergies are a setup for a variety of complications. A lot of them are infectious, sinus infections, bronchitis, pneumonia, otitis media, and even asthma. And I spend a lot of my time towards the middle and end of the pollen season and into the summer treating complications of people who have been inadequately treated for their allergies.
Is that then paid for by the Oregon Health Plan?
If it's a qualifying condition, certainly acute bronchitis, acute sinusitis, pneumonia, asthma, yeah, those are all covered.
So in reality, they're causing themselves to have to pay more than they would have to pay.
In my judgment, that's correct.
I have a comment that was passed to me concerning the diagnosis on a prescription. Maybe you can talk to that a little more, as being the ethics part of it, because of patient confidentiality. There's a problem with doing that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think we would have to be careful about what we put on prescriptions.
I guess it bothers me that somehow or another between our agencies we don't have some kind of cooperation where we look at these things and we can make the determination of how we treat them and how we require reporting and one thing and another in a way that turns around and not only perhaps costs further money to the agency involved, but also would up the cost considerably to other agencies. And I see a lack of this in this coordination in the budget-making process. And I see him strike, as you, for instance, here you're striking out against a few particular drugs that seem to raise your costs out without any particular consideration of what the influence is on the people that take those drugs and what the physical ramifications are to them or their employers or to other agencies. And this absolutely bothers me. It doesn't make sense to me to do that. And from that standpoint, it's something I guess that, because we don't have the time today, that I'd like to pursue at a later date. But in any event, I appreciate it. The time that doctors come in here and tell us, and we'll try to see if we can work on this thing a little more in the future and streamline some things, if nothing else. And also, what I would like to do is to try to get some kind of an idea of approximately, if there was any way of telling, what percentage of the patients wind up coming to you because they haven't had a decent drug to use in the first place. Because they've used something that was outdated and it's not done the job, and so they wind up in your office, which then puts them under the Oregon Health Plan, because these are the things that we need to examine if it would be easier to do something like that, and we'd have to work through it. From what I understand, the health Commission, the Services Commission can make some changes and some recommendations and things like that from time to time, and I would like to give some direction to them to concentrate on some of these things that might not only relieve people's symptoms and the
problems, but that would cut to the chase and pay for these things up front and save the money down the line, because I would guess that it's not cheap and it's not much fun for people to have to continue on to the specialist for some period of time when they might have gotten cured in the first place, and all of us would save money and time and problems in the future. So thank you for coming, and appreciate Dr. Kay's testimony here today, and I feel that it was pretty valuable insight for us to get a chance to put on record how some of these drugs react and what they do to us, because apparently they have quite significance, far more than just for the Health and Human Services Committee. So, public hearing on Senate Bill 824, and I'm going to reopen on Senate Bill 708. Where are we at? Frank, I don't know whether you want to stick with me or not.
I'm going to stay here as long as there are people, because there are obviously, in the interest of fairness, two sides of the issue.
Yes, so that's what I plan to
do. I want to start close
with your...
I suppose if the Senate President calls you up there for a vote, then we'll have to go.
Tim Krull, Roger Martin, James Hayes, and that'll do it for a moment here.
Thank you, Senator Fisher. My name is Tim Krull. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Rehabilitation Association. We represent nonprofit community providers and services.
I would take it you have some folks here that you're representing today?
Yes, Senator, we have quite a few people with disabilities who are vitally concerned about the future of this law.
Could I have them raise their hands or give them some indication of who all they are here?
I think there's a whole lot more out in the hall and a whole lot more over here earlier.
All right.
There's a lot of mess.
Thank you for your interest, and thank you for being willing to wait here for it, and apologize for the fact that we get rushed out here sometimes in the process of working on issues. Go ahead,
Senator. This law has been around 22 years. It was passed at our request, carried by then-Representative David Frohnmayer, passed both houses unanimously. It has proven to be a very effective tool for employing people with disabilities. In light of the time constraints you're under and the points that were raised by the Fair Competition Alliance, I'll just address a few of those in our written testimony. You can see other things. One of the contentions is that there is no definition of disability within the law. In fact, there is a definition. It has not changed since 1977, and it states that those people who are so disabled that they are not able to be fully competitively employed are considered disabled for the purposes of this law. That is a very similar definition to the Vocational Rehabilitation Division. And one of the things we've given you is a chart that shows circles of disabilities of different types and who certifies them. The Mental Health Division and the Vocational Rehabilitation Division walked us through this process, us being Senate Representative Loken's committee last week, that includes DOS and the business people and QRS. Within the voc rehab definition, there are smaller definitions relating to specific types of disability. The Products of Disabled Individuals definition falls very concurrent with the voc rehab definition. A statement is made that all public contracts are mandated to go to these programs. In fact, less than 2% of all public contracts are being performed by qualified rehabilitation facilities. They're not mandated to use them. They're mandated to see if it can work. And in many cases, we can't provide the job. We can't provide the work. There are many things we cannot do. So less than 2% of all the public policy. I have a feeling you're going to leave.
I think we've just been preempted. Senator Shields, you got some suggestions here of how we...
And now I sit on the floor of the Senate winner.
I'm in a real corner. I think what we need to do is to make a time certain to go ahead and do this. We obviously, we've got this on record.
got it open so it can be discussed.
All right, go ahead. You can be on the phone. I don't know what the... If we gave this the first and next week and put these two bills up only, would that be a reasonable thing to do? And I apologize to the folks that
make sure
that we try to do our best, and sometimes our best is not good. And I've always tried to allow folks to testify as much as they wanted to in my committee meetings and not try to exclude anyone. And I'm willing to take next Thursday and devote it strictly to these two issues and not have anything else impede that. And if we could arrange that, I'll just go ahead because we are getting pressure on us to go up there and get into session. And I know that it's important for them up there to get their work done.
Senator Shields, I just wanted to be on record saying that I, too, I mean, you may have other things to do next Thursday, but if we would start with this, that means we start at 8 o'clock? Is that what you're
saying? I'm willing to start at 8 o'clock and have these two things limited to that only. I think we can get around that and just concentrate strictly on these two things.
We'll be here, Senator.
I would recommend that everybody get a hold of the amendments that are involved and look through them and be familiar with them so that we can comment on those rather than on the draft of Bill 634 itself. Roger, is that okay with,
sure.
with you folks?
Senator Jim, can you be here next week?
Yes.
Senator Fisher, I wanted to make one comment, and that was just to thank all the folks that put so much extra work to get folks with disabilities down here. I know how difficult that is, and I'll try my best to get the other members of the committee here at 8 o'clock next Thursday so we can start right on time and give everybody a chance to be heard. Okay?
Thank you, Senator. I know some staff got up at 4 o'clock to be here and bring people here.
Yes, I'm very well aware of that, and it's appreciated and noted, and again, my apologies to the committee chair for not getting our time scheduled like I would have liked to have today. Close the session on Senate Health and Human Services Fund.
You got it, Debbie. Thank you.